Marty Moss Cohen. Mike Rose has written a book about and for those he calls second chancers. These are the people who have had struggles in school and in life, and after some false starts and detours, are enrolling in adult education classes, community colleges, and four-year colleges. They are single parents and veterans. Some are employed. Some are looking for work. They are older than the traditional college student, and chances are they are studying part-time. They also bring a wealth of knowledge and experience to the classroom. Mike Rose writes about them in his new book, Back to School, Why Everyone Deserves a Second Chance at Education. Rose was the first in his family to go to college and has a deep appreciation for the kind of intelligence it takes to do physical labor. Mike Rose is a writer, educator, and professor at the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies, and he joins us on Radio Times. And Mike Rose, nice to have you back on the show.
Oh, thanks, Marty. It's nice to be back.
So is this a new phenomenon, these second chancers, as you describe them?
Well, yes and no. What's new is, as you just pointed out in your lead, is that what's rapidly happening is that the average age of a college student in the United States is 28, as you pointed out. Something like 45%, I think, of students in college now would be considered quote-unquote non-traditional students. You know, that is folks coming in who aren't coming in right out of high school. As you point out, they're working part-time. Often they have families. So the increase in those numbers is a new phenomenon. Mm. But what's not new, and this I find fascinating, is that, you know, since the early days of the Republic, we Americans have developed ways to further educate ourselves after whatever formal schooling we've had is over. You know, when you look back into our history, we've got, in the early 19th century, there's like literacy clubs, there's mechanics institutes, there's big, very popular public lectures. You have the rise of university extensions. Unions, early unions like the Knights of Labor had significant educational programs, and farmers' organizations like the Grange also had significant educational programs. So this continues all the way down through our time. And in fact, you know, you could think of the first GI Bill as being in this tradition. I mean, something like 8 million veterans benefited from that legislation, and it ended up changing the face of higher education in America. So part of this is new and interesting in that the numbers are shifting in the way that we described, but in terms of Americans trying to improve themselves, goes way far back in our history.
Does that speak to this so-called American optimism? This, I don't know if it still exists today because of all these troubles we're dealing with, but
right,
that kind of can-do spirit that we have associated with Americans?
I think that really is true. I mean, that's, you know, we conceive of ourselves as an independent, strong people, folks who are not limited by our backgrounds. I mean, that's what distinguished us from Europe in the minds of, you know, our founding fathers, is that we were fresh in some ways. We weren't bound by all the strictures of aristocracy and your position at birth. We believe in mobility and an opportunity. And I think that all of these various institutions, down to our own community colleges and adult schools and occupational centers, these are all ways that we try to live out that vision of the country. That's why I think they're so important.
Well, what's so interesting is over the last couple of years, we've done many, many shows about education, and they all tend to be critical about the problems in our system, about the dropout rate. So I have to say it's almost shocking to me to be talking about education in these glowing kinds of terms.
Yeah, it's a little unusual.
It is. I mean, I appreciate it, but it's, you know, I think we're and there's much to criticize, I think, in our education system,
right,
but I don't want to forget what's good about it.
Well, you know, you just put your finger on something I think that is crucial, and it's been a theme I've hit in a lot of the work I've done over the years, and that is that one and the same time, we absolutely have to be critical and demanding of our educational institutions, whether we're talking about K through 12 or the kinds of institutions we're talking about now, or our Ivy League schools, whatever level we're talking about, I think we have a civic responsibility to be critical, to be clear-eyed. The statistics for the kinds of institutions I'm talking about are not great. I mean, something like 30%, just 30% of people who enter the community college end up getting a 2-year degree or a certificate of some kind within 4 years, 4 to 6 years. So those are terrible numbers, and a lot of people are trying to do something about that. We absolutely have to be clear-eyed about the limitations of these institutions. But to take your point, if all we do is see the negative and we don't seek out all the examples of what happened, of what's being done right, then I think we're only getting half the picture. I mean, if we don't have these images of possibility, what can we build on? You know, I mean, what are we shooting for as we criticize the status quo? So I'm a firm believer, Marty, in trying to, at one and the same time, hold in our field of vision everything that's wrong and everything that needs to be fixed, but also all these images of excellence that exist right now, because we learn from those.
Well, you have many examples of people that you met in writing this book and in thinking about these second chancers, these non-traditional learners. And one of the people you write about is a guy named Henry, who says, look, I did a lot of really dumb things, and clearly he did in his life. But he, I guess, learned from them and was able to turn his life around. Help us understand what Henry can teach us.
Right. I met so many people, men and women like Henry. I'll tell you a teeny bit about his story. Now, his story is a kind of an extreme one because of the circumstances. But in terms of the way he sees what happened to him, it's not extreme at all. So Henry is a young man. When I met him, he was in a wheelchair. And he's in a wheelchair because he was shot in a gang fight. Mm. So here's a guy. This is such a typical story. He was doing okay in school. He was in sports. He had a decent grade point average. And then he got caught up in street life. And that led to what he admits was just a lot of really stupid stuff, to use his phrase. And he ended up running with a gang. And in an encounter, he got shot in the spine and paralyzed from the waist down. Mm. So during this whole year of rehab, you can imagine he's going through all kinds of self-examination. And one of the things that hits him, this is such a powerful sentence, he said, you know, I realize that I may not have the use of my legs, but I have the use of my mind. And he started looking online, and he found a community college relatively close to him, like a commuter train ride away. He gathered up everything he could find, all his documents. He went there the next day, enrolled, and did very well and was pursuing an occupational certificate of some kind. But here's the interesting thing, Marty, and this is the kind of stuff that can happen. It would have been, the story would be a beautiful story if we even just stopped there, you know, if he got his occupational certificate and went out into the world. But he had a little job working the front desk at a tutoring center on campus. So he's sitting there checking people in, and he's watching all this stuff go on. He's watching these people come in to get work done with their assignments. And he's watching all these tutors working so hard to help them. And he said another light bulb went on. He realized, you know, I want to learn math. I want to learn English. I want to get an associate's degree. I want to transfer. And he's on the road now to go to a 4-year school, and what he wants to do is get a degree that will enable him to work with kids just like he was. And can you imagine a better person to be doing that kind of work, the kind of credibility he's going to carry, and the kind of understanding that he has about street life and its consequences? And so here we go, shifting, taking somebody who was at one point a liability to society, becoming a very powerful asset.
you talk about that what he learned from street life, and I know that having interviewed you before and a little bit about you and the fact that your mom worked as a waitress pretty much her whole life, and you and your dad would watch her work, and you have a deep and abiding appreciation for the sort of non-academic student or the way people use their brains in dealing with what looks like very physical and non-academic work.
Right. That's hugely important to me. Yeah, I'm the first in my family to even go to college. Actually, I'm about the third in my family to graduate from high school. So all of my forebears made their living in the East Coast Rust Belt industries, and then, as you just mentioned, my mother was a waitress her whole life and kept food on the table that way. And so, you know, just growing up, I saw what it took to do this kind of work, and it took not only a lot of physical prowess, but some real brains. And so in The Mind at Work is the book you're talking about. In that book, I go to some pains to very carefully document all of the mental activity involved in everything from styling hair to navigating a busy restaurant at rush hour to welding, carpentry, plumbing, you name it, because I think that whole domain of cognition, that whole domain of intelligence is kind of lost to us today in this high-tech era, and yet it's what makes the world go round. And I guess that also gives me a real appreciation for what these occupational programs can achieve in the colleges that I was in, the community colleges I was visiting. I mean, what I saw happen again and again is, you know, folks coming in who didn't do well in school and were stuck in dead-end jobs or were unemployed or just kind of lost, and finding themselves, you know, in a cosmetology or fashion or welding or automotive trades program, building skills, developing knowledge, getting a sense of themselves as being competent and able to do things, and really changing the way they see themselves and developing a whole set of marketable skills in the process. Powerful thing.
Indeed. And we're almost up on a break here. I mean, it does raise questions about whether high schools have a kind of curriculum and approach to teaching that will reach these kinds of students so they don't drop out of high school.
Right. And we can talk about that more after the break if you want, but I think it touches on a really important question about vocational education, how well that's been done or not been done, what might be done with it now, and the kind of pathway that it leads you on. So if you want, after the break, we can continue that discussion.
What a cooperative guest you are. You know all about our breaks, and you set it up perfectly for me. We are going to take that break and then get back to our conversation with Mike Rose. He's a writer, educator, professor at the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies, and he's got a new book. It's called Back to School, Why Everyone Deserves a Second Chance at Education. And underneath that, it says, an argument for democratizing knowledge in America. We're going to take that short break, get back to our conversation, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Medford Lee's, a not-for-profit community serving those ages 55-plus and guided by Quaker principles, supports WHYY. This fall, there's an opportunity to explore, learn, and discover with Medford Lee's as they launch their new Pathways series. Pathways features public programming on topics covering art, politics, music, history, horticulture, and more. Full details about Medford Lee's public events, educational programming, and its campuses in Medford and Lumberton, New Jersey, are online at medfordlees.org.
Next time in Studio 360, The Satanic Verses was a worldwide bestseller, but its author spent almost a decade hiding from the Ayatollah Khomeini's executioners. I'll talk with Salman Rushdie about his new memoir next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
So your baby's under the weather, your childcare is shaky, but you have to go to work. What do you do? American University professor Adrienne Pine took the baby to class and breastfed her while there. She says it was no big deal, so why did the story end up on the front page of the Washington Post? Big deal or stupid dust-up? We'll ask our moms next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Mike Rose, who has had a long-standing interest in non-traditional learners, whom he calls a second-chance society. These are perhaps single parents or veterans or former high school dropouts, adults in their 30s and 40s who are going back to schools and taking classes, adult classes, and going to community colleges, getting that GED. And he says it's time to think about all the things that they do, that they bring to a classroom, and how they are contributing to the country. As I said earlier, we were frankly, or I was frankly surprised to do a show that about some of the good things that are happening when it comes to college and education. But certainly Mike Rose has been doing this for some time now. He's a professor at the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies. And he's written several books, Why School, Lives on the Boundary, The Mind at Work, and Possible Lives. And we are hooking up with him once again and obviously taking phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And as he said, the average age for a college student these days is something like 28 years, a far cry from those students who graduate from high school and go directly on to college. And about 45% of college classes these days made up of these non-traditional learners, as he calls them, part of this second-chance society. If that sounds like you, we'd like to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And I had interviewed Mike Rose a couple of years ago when his a previous book had come out, and I was happy to say when I saw the book coming through the mail at Radio Times that he was back, and that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And Mike, you're back with us?
I am.
Okay, very good. Right before the break, you were talking about the importance of, and then we should talk about vocational education. And I scribbled down during the break, having done several shows about a program that started at a West Philadelphia high school. In fact, it's called West Philadelphia High School, an automotive program started after school. These high school students have gone on to create and build amazing cars, or to get us something like 100 miles per gallon. And it's an example, I think, of vocational education that not just benefits students, but has such a ripple effect on our education system. Can you speak about what you see as the possibilities, the role of vocational education?
Right, absolutely. So let me just begin with a very quick historical note that, you know, vocational education in our schools started formally in the United States maybe 100 years ago or so. And one of the problems with traditional vocational education is that it was pretty uneven. I mean, there were some, you know, terrific programs, terrific teachers, people learned a lot, but a number of reports that were done 20, 30 years ago on the nature of vocational education and what had happened indicated that too often they focused on kind of narrow job skills and not on the whole conceptual, intellectual dimension of work that you and I were talking about right before the break. And so, and furthermore, the other courses that students took along with their vocational courses, you know, the general English and math and all that, were not at all that challenging. So vocational education came under quite a bit of scrutiny, and as you know, a lot of programs were shut down. But what's happening now is that there are new programs emerging and old ones being revitalized that are the kind of thing you're talking about, that go more deeply into the conceptual side of this work in this example you're mentioning of the automotive trades, and really pushing students to use their minds to do the kinds of assignments, tasks you're talking about. Another thing that's been going on with vocational education is there's been an attempt to try and bridge this awful divide that developed starting 100 years ago between the academic course of study and the vocational course of study, like those two things are somehow completely separate.
Right.
And so now you see a lot of programs, like in the community colleges I'm at, people are experimenting with, you know, blending the mathematics and blending the literacy stuff in with automotive trades or cosmetology or fashion or whatever, giving mathematics and writing and reading a much more meaningful context. So I think all these new programs that are emerging have so much promise, and the kind of place you're talking about seems to exemplify that. What's crucial is that I think these programs are honoring the rich conceptual intellectual side of this work. It involves problem solving and troubleshooting and building a knowledge base and thinking creatively, making sure that that gets emphasized as much as just raw technique.
You speak to this dichotomy we have about mind and body. I mean, it's so weird that in 2012 we're still thinking about mind and body, but I think it's a reflex we seem to have.
It's a cultural reflex. I mean, it goes back hundreds of years in Western thought, you know, and it's just led to a host of problems, I think, and one of them is what we're talking about, this kind of institutionalization in the American high school of this deep separation between the academic side of things and the vocational side of things. And it very clearly, it was the academic side of things that got identified with smarts and intelligence and creativity and promise and all of that, and the vocational side got identified with, you know, a lot less. So it's just created a lot of problems that I think we now are trying to address, trying to bridge that divide.
So much of education, especially in high school and the lower grades, is about testing, you know, making sure that students have a basic knowledge of the world. And I think a hyper-focus, whether it's a Race to the Top under Obama or No Child Left Behind under Bush. But looking at the students that we're talking about, and chances are they probably don't do so well on these tests. But what are the tests missing, and can we construct a test that tells us more about a student, that's more helpful about how to educate that particular student?
Right. Well, first of all, yeah, there's many, many, many other ways to test and assess that get to a broader range of abilities and competencies. I think the thing that's disturbing to a lot of educators about No Child Left Behind and then carried over into Race to the Top is that the tests are pretty basic tests of mathematics and reading. Now, those are core subjects, so I don't want to for a moment downplay the importance of young people mastering those skills. But what concerns everybody is that testing tail has ended up wagging the dog, so that we know from a lot of studies that in schools that are under pressure to meet their marks in those tests, so much else gets thrown aside. So the curriculum becomes very narrowed. Not only are art and music and that sort of thing thrown out the window, but in fact even history, social studies, and even some science is sold short, so that people just zero in on those two subjects and those tests. The further problem, Marty, is that the way those tests are set up, I'm not sure that so if people do okay on them, it indicates a basic skill level of competence, and that's hugely important. But then the question is, where do we go from there? You know, how do we help people become more literate and more mathematically aware and more mathematically knowledgeable? The tests constrain in too many ways, and as I say, they end up wagging the dog of what ought to go on in school. Those core subjects for sure, but think of all else that's supposed to go on in school when school is done right, all the kind of social and emotional things that go on with young people, all the other kinds of learning, all the the different interests that they might develop in, anything from the arts through the sciences through history, a lot of that's going to get short shrift.
And that's Mike Rose, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's called Back to School, Why Everyone Deserves a Second Chance at Education. And he is a professor at the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies, and the author of a number of books looking at what he calls non-traditional learners. And we have a full bank of calls, a lot of people that want to talk to you. Let me get Delano from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Delano, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I really appreciate the topic, and I'm definitely going to pick up the book. My question is actually around, I actually run an adult program for these kind of returning students through Eastern University in Philadelphia.
Oh, great.
And one of the things I find is that the challenges, you know, life, working, you know, kids, paying bills, all these kind of life issues are really barriers for a lot of adult returning students in the way that they weren't before when they were high school students. So I'm wondering if the author has found character qualities that are kind of keys to success for these students. I mean, what kind of sets some students apart that enables them to kind of go ahead and get the degree and then move on to a career that they want? And I can take the answer off the air.
Yeah, Dylan, it's a great question. Now, Mike Rose, go ahead.
Yeah, it is a great question. Well, first of all, he hits on such a huge point that sometimes gets lost in these discussions about the high dropout rates or the lack of completion rates in community colleges and adult schools. We're talking about people who have families and who must work and who have a host of responsibilities and bills to pay. So just right out of the gate, they are up against challenges that the 18 or 19-year-old coming out of high school and into these institutions doesn't have. That's a huge point, and I don't think we should ever forget it. Now, clearly some of these folks are coming back at a time when things are more in place for them to be able to continue their studies. So that's important to remember, too. I mean, some folks come at a time that's just not good for them in terms of their other responsibilities. Others are able to come at a time when things are going to work out well. So now to his point, yeah, I see that too, that there's some people that come and they are just so motivated. There's a high level of commitment. They've already done kinds of work or raised families that give them a sense of goal setting and follow through, these kinds of characteristics that are so important. So they come then with some of these life skills that they've learned, and a sense of commitment, a sense of motivation, and a real desire to follow through.
Delano, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Mike Rose is picking up on that. You also write about the number of veterans who are going back to school. And I don't know whether this is a kind of a modern-day GI Bill, but one would assume, especially if they've been in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, the wealth of experience that they would bring to a classroom.
Yeah, boy, that is... That's true on so many levels. And the interesting thing that I find, you know, and I'm sure you've had, I bet you've had guests on who've talked about this.
Sure.
Another thing that they bring is a real sense of that this is important. And they sometimes get frustrated with their younger classmates, you know, who are not as maybe goal-focused as they are. I mean, they've been through something, and they definitely want to improve their lot. They have challenges, too. You know, we've certainly read about all that. They have challenges, you know, for everything from maybe they didn't have such great reading and writing skills when they left high school, and now they've got to build those again, or the kinds of challenges that come with being in a war zone. So it's not like they're without problems,
indeed,
but they certainly come with a sense of can-do and a desire to get their lives into the next phase of things.
Let me get Taliba from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there.
Yeah, it's interesting that your guest mentioned about life skills and experience helping in school, because I recently graduated from Drexel, and let's just say I'm well over 50 years of age.
You go. That's great.
Yeah, and I found that, well, there were a lot of challenges, but, you know, because of being older, I had, like, additional resources and experience to help me. Like, for instance, my son tutored me. My son, the engineer, tutored me. And I had, like, classmates who were like that, too. We were all using our children to teach us, you know, the software and to help us with our statistics and things like that. And also, like, my biggest challenge was with financial aid because, you know, when you're working, sure. And, you can't really borrow enough money to go to school often, and it's, like, really hard when they say, well, get your parents to co-sign. Well, your parents are deceased. You know, how can you get your parents to co-sign when you're 50 years old? And so, but because of my work experience, because I was a financial aid administrator, as a matter of fact, about 20 years ago, I knew about, like, the different, like, laws and exceptions, et cetera, that my assistant financial aid director didn't know about.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I was able to use what I knew to, you know, like, go around her and go above her to get the money that I needed. And when I started college as a, you know, a teenager, I wouldn't have known those things.
Well, Taliba, let me take your call, and I appreciate that you called into Radio Times because it sounds like you could be in Mike Rose's book. Mike, anything you want to say back to Taliba?
Well, just first of all, big-time congratulations.
Yeah.
But she brings up a really interesting thing that you also see, and that's sometimes parents and kids coming either coming back to school together or, as she said, parents who will go to their children for, particularly I found, for help with the computer, right? Because the kids are real computer savvy, and some of these classes that the students are taking require, you know, that they do stuff online, and their children have been great assists for them. So she brings up a really nice point about a kind of intergenerational thing that can happen here.
About a minute before our second break here, but she also talks about going into debt, and it seems that
yeah.
Getting a higher education degree is so expensive, and of course with a struggling economy, not clear that you're going to get the kind of job that you could pay it back in a timely
right.
way.
Right. Well, it's why I'm a big fan of public institutions, and I know certainly that public 4 years in universities are also skyrocketing, but places like the community college and some state colleges, you know, are still, even though they cost money, and I don't want to downplay that, mm-hmm. but they are still a good bargain and you know, really worthy of people taking advantage of them.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Taliba, thanks for the call to Radio Times, and congratulations on that degree. The phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We are talking about non-traditional students, and as our guest says, they belong to the Second Chance Society. He writes about them in his new book, and it's called Back to School, Why Everyone Deserves a Second Chance at Education. Mike Rose teaches at UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Services. We'll take our information studies, and we're going to take a short break and then get back to our conversation. A couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Are we talking about you? Give us a call. We'll be right back.
Thomas Jefferson University Hospital supports WHYY and supports patients who have prostate cancer with more than just the latest treatments. Jefferson's Buddy program puts patients with prostate cancer, men who sometimes find it difficult to discuss their condition, in touch with former patients they can talk to. Jefferson is a National Cancer Institute designated center. More information available on the web at jeffersonhospital.org or at 1-800-JEFF-NOW.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Gaith Abdul Ahad talks about traveling with Syrian rebel fighters for his new PBS Frontline documentary. He says the rebels don't have enough helmets, flak jackets, or experience.
In Syria, you meet someone in the morning and they die in the end of the day. As one of the officers was saying, the only thing we have plenty of is men.
Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The presidential campaigns are spending lots for online and social media ads. What are they getting in return? Also, the Boston doctor who was in Benghazi to meet with Ambassador Chris Stevens the day he was killed. We'll find out why. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. If you attended college, did you enroll directly out of high school, or are you like one of the 45% of students that our guest has been talking about that took longer to find their way to higher education? These are non-traditional students, second chancers, as Mike Rose calls them, people interested in reinventing themselves. Perhaps they've had some kind of financial or personal obstacles or couldn't quite find the right fit, but they are back in school, and that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Mike Rose, I do want to go back to our callers, but I do have a question about remedial education programs in college. Some people have criticized those programs, saying, look, that means high schools aren't doing their job. They're not giving students the kind of skills that they need to make it at the college level. Are you a believer in remedial programs in college?
Yes, I am. I don't want to downplay at all the point you just made. I mean, it is a shame that so many people come to college with less than adequate reading and writing and mathematical skills. But there's a couple things to keep in mind. One is some kind of remediation has been in American higher education since the 19th century. I mean, it predates organized athletics. In the mid-1800s, something like 30 or 40% of people enrolling in college were in what they called a preparatory program because they weren't quite ready for the curriculum. As we moved into the beginning of the 19th century, it was like 40%, I think. If you look back in the last 40 or 50 years, let's look at Berkeley in 1970, 50% of their students were being held for remedial English. Mm-hmm. So this remediation business, that is trying to bring students up to some level of proficiency that's required for college work, has just been with us. And I think one reason is because we're an open educational system. You know, we don't have a series of very tightly controlled tests and benchmarks and gateways that people need to pass through, as you would have in some other countries. So in a way, it's the price we pay for something that I think a lot of us would affirm, and that is the openness of our educational system. So having said that, we do have high numbers of students who need some kind of work in reading, writing, or mathematics. At the four-year level, I think it's something like 35 or 40%. In community colleges, it's much higher. Mm. I don't think we've done a particularly good job, Marty, at this remediation business. And just like with Voc Ed, there's a lot of stuff going on now around the country that's really exciting. People are rethinking completely the way we do remediation and, blending it, as I think I mentioned before, blending remedial courses in math or writing in with occupational courses or with other academic courses, psychology, philosophy, history, literature, whatever, so that the work becomes more meaningful and oriented toward college-level goals. That's one thing folks are doing. They're also rethinking the curriculum they offer so that it's not just a sort of skills and drills, workbook-based curriculum, but one that really does foster a richer kind of literacy or numeracy. So we're at a propitious time. It's a good time right now for this. A A lot of smart people are interested in it. There's philanthropic money that's flowing to these ventures. And I'm thinking that we're going to see a bit of a turn in the corner of our work with remediation.
That's good news. Good to hear. Let me get Annette from Norristown to join our conversation. Annette, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello, Marty. I love this program.
Thank you.
I'm 71, and I'm I've gone back to school four times since I graduated from college in 1963.
Continuing education, right, Annette?
Pardon?
Continuing education.
Yes.
Ooh, I think we might have lost Annette. I'm sorry to hear that. But, you know, here's another example, Mike Rose, of an older person returning to school and picking up on what you said earlier about this seems to be what Americans have done through history.
Yeah. I mean, isn't it interesting the calls we got? We got a call from the woman who was in her 50s, and here we get this call from Annette who's 71. I mean, I think this is a particularly American kind of thing to do, right? This thought that there's more I want to do, there's more I want to learn, I want to get another shot or yet another shot at this. I'm glad we're getting these calls.
Yeah, me too. Reinvention. Let's try Rob from Havertown. And Rob, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty. Thanks for a great show.
Thank you.
I made a transition a few years ago. It was financially very difficult to do and challenging. It took some creativity. But I went from working in union carpentry, which was hard physical work, particularly with concrete on commercial projects, to being in a Philly public school teaching music at the elementary level. And I made the change because people asked me, I say, well, I just wanted to die happy. And it also allows me to work longer because physically I simply couldn't have continued to do that.
So do you think you'll die happy, Rob?
Oh, yeah. So here's a plug for the people who are considering teaching. It's not going to be easy to make the transition, and the system isn't going to be friendly to the situation they're in, but try it. The Philly public schools, all public schools need you and your experience.
Rob, a quick question before we hear from Mike Rose. As you said, you were a carpenter. Had you gone to college or gotten an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree as you were working as a carpenter?
No, I did afterwards because I knew the program was a traditional program and I wouldn't have the opportunity to do a part-time program. And so it was a really big step off the cliff, as it were.
But it sounds like a step in the right direction.
Get out there and teach. It's fabulous.
Mike Rose, music to your ears.
Yeah,
especially from an
right?
elementary. Exactly,
yeah.
Literally.
I mean, first of all, the plug for teaching, you know, good for him, yeah. Good for Rob. But again, it's Marty, you know, we keep getting these examples of this kind of this reinvention, and it is such an American thing. You know, it runs throughout our literature, it runs throughout our popular culture. It runs throughout our history. It's one of the ways we talk about ourselves. We can reinvent ourselves. As he points out, it's not always easy. And in some cases, folks are prevented from doing it because of circumstances, because of resources, because of different kinds of bias and prejudice. I don't want to say it's an easy thing, and I don't want to say it's automatic, mm-hmm. but it is a powerful strain in the American character.
Rob, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Mike Rose, going back to your book, and I don't want to sugarcoat what we're talking about, but you describe an adult school where there was a bulletin board where people could post anonymous messages, and you have a couple of them here. All of them kind of in Rob's vein, which is, you know, I hope that in the next year I improve even more than I did in 2011. I'm really struggling to get my high school diploma, but I know I will someday. Again, this sense of hopefulness and optimism.
Yeah, it's really something, isn't it? There's another piece of all this that really strikes me, Marty, and that is, so those kinds of testaments you're talking about that folks had written up on these bulletin boards, it's so interesting when you spend time in these different programs, whether they're adult school programs or community college programs, and you're listening to folks who are coming back to school after a long time out, and these are often people who have had a hard time of it. The reasons that they come back, that they articulate, either in writing or in speech are often reasons that include the economic. I mean, obviously folks are going back to school because they want to try and make themselves more economically viable. They want to try and get a job that's got some kind of stability to it. But the other reasons that they articulate with some frequency are things like, you know, I want to learn how to read and write better. I want to be a role model for my kids. I want to learn more things about the world. I want to feel more involved. I want to make school a good thing for me. And they'll even use phrases like, I want to change who I am. Mm. So the reasons that they give certainly have to do with economics, but they also have to do with so much else. So this whole thrust of ours, this whole kind of second chance stuff, this whole optimism and coming back to school thing, people do it for lots of reasons. Economically, for sure. It's an economic motive is primary. But so many other reasons, and they're reflected in these bulletin board clips that you read, as well as just any conversation that you have with a group of folks who are returning to school.
Let's see what Monica from Northfield has to say. Monica, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I'm a professor at the local community college here in Atlantic County, and I teach ESL to adults. I also teach developmental English, and I just wanted to say I'm enjoying the program, but also that this has been a blessing for me to teach remedial English. Mm. I get a chance to really learn about the lives of my students, and many of them are non-traditional, and a lot of them are second-chance kids because they didn't do well in high school, and they've lost faith in themselves. And just to show them that they have a voice, to listen to them, and then develop their words into clear sentences and paragraphs is a blessing. So thank you so much.
Oh, Monica, thank you for what you're doing. Mike Rose, any thoughts?
Whoa, boy!
Whoa is right.
So I also taught remedial writing for many years. So I am so on board with what Monica's talking about. It's, you know, for all the bad press it gets, you were talking about that a little bit ago, it's powerful work. It is remarkably important and powerful work, and Monica's making a difference in some of those students' lives. And, you know, and that's huge. If she's able to move someone from being terrified of writing anything and not being very skilled at it, and if she's able to move them to a place where they're doing better, they're beginning to get a little more confidence in themselves as writers, they're ready to take the next course in the sequence, they're ready to see writing in a different way and reassess who they are, think of how powerful that is, what a role that she plays in their lives. So based on what she said, but also based on my many years of doing this kind of teaching, I can tell you it's powerful work.
Monica, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let's try Paul from Kutztown. And Paul, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Okay. I just pulled over. I'm currently on my way to school. I'm attending Kutztown University.
Oh, sure.
I'm going for my bachelor's degree in molecular biology. I'm 42 years old, and hopefully I'll be done this spring. I've been attending college courses since the mid-90s. I went to a community college part-time and got my associate's degree in biotechnology. I got a job in that field. I went and worked, and when it came time for a promotion, I was bypassed because I didn't have my bachelor's degree. Mm-hmm. And this really, really bothered me because I put a lot of work in. And I was doing work alongside people with bachelor's degrees, putting out product that was just as good as theirs, but I got bypassed only because I didn't have that piece of paper. And I don't mean to demean and call it a piece of paper, but that's how I felt at the time.
Right.
So now, my wife and I have two children. I'm married. I have a house. I have a mortgage. It's hard, but we saved up. I applied to Kutztown. I went part time. I worked a second shift job at night so I can go there. I commute and left. Now, on my final year, we decided instead of prolonging this, let's just save our pennies, get it done in these next two semesters, go full time and get it done. It's costing quite a bit of money. It's a sacrifice. I'm commuting. the logistics of having two children, one child in first grade. The reason we couldn't do it before is because kindergarten was half day and it would have been an added expense of daycare. So it's hard. And the other thing I noticed is that the four-year schools are not catered towards adult students because they don't offer night courses.
Well, Paul, first of all, I appreciate your call to Radio Times, and I think you're inspiring a lot of people, and your determination to get this piece of paper as you describe it. Let me give Mike Rosa a chance to respond to, and you raise a whole host of important questions. Let me give Mike Rosa a chance to respond.
Well, again, big congratulations, right? I mean, Paul has obviously gone through he's made an extraordinary number of sacrifices. He and his family have made an extraordinary number of sacrifices to get this degree, and he's so right, right? I can't, again, I've run into so many folks who have been in the workforce. They're coming back to school because, it's a credentialing society, and the credentials matter, and people don't have a degree, and it limits them. There's a glass ceiling that they hit. So, he's made a wise decision, although it's clearly costing him. But he brings up, as you said, a number of good points. The one that I want to jump on is, again, colleges are set up, and people are really thinking about this now, but colleges are set up to meet the kid who's 18, 19 years old coming out of high school. In our society, that's this period of kind of exploration. You haven't married for the most part. You haven't married yet. If you're working, you're working part-time. It's not like your career job. Colleges are set up for that kind of person. Mm. And so you get somebody like Paul coming in to his college, and his college isn't set up in a way, like he mentioned, no night classes, but also I'm sure there's other things too, like what kind of tutoring is available, and what about counseling services, and what other kinds of services are there? So how is the curriculum structured? How are student services structured? Just what is the attitude of the campus toward these folks? I mean, are people thinking a lot about the fact that the increasing numbers of students fit profiles like Paul?
Well, Mike,
this is the big shift that we have to go through now.
Indeed, and I wish we could go on. They're playing my song. I have to end the hour. Mike Rose, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The book is Back to School. Fred Snyder, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder, with assistance from Jonathan Bess and Jared Brausch, our intern. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us, and especially for those phone calls. And coming up,